The reason I'm kind of going first, our format's a little different tonight. I don't know how long this is going to be. So I figured, you know, put it at first, be safe. So I'm supposed to talk about glorify tonight. If y'all remember, David talked about glory last week. I'm not sure how much I'll end up talking about that, but I might get around to it. We'll see. So it might be kind of roundabout, though, until we get there. So forgive me if I'm drawing on for a long time. But just because I had books all around my office doesn't mean I read all of them. So I mean, you play that game too, right? You got, like, you know, all these books laying around. People think you're all smart and you, like, haven't done a thing yet. But anyway, I'm talking about some stuff tonight that's somewhat personal, some family things. Some of you might have been in that boat before, have gone through the same type of things. So I don't think I'm, you know, the only person, you know, who's gone through this kind of stuff and, you know, bestowing some kind of wisdom or whatever because of it. But anyway, just some thoughts that I've put together to talk about what I'm going to talk about. So anyway, this is why I'm first, because I'll just start talking for a really long time. All right. My oldest sister, her name is Chandra. She's the oldest of five kids. That's her next to Taryn. I regard her very highly. She's definitely my hero, and I talk about her a lot. She married Drew right out of college. She went to ACU, and soon after that, she became pregnant. And I remember when she broke the news to all the family. We had, like, lots of relatives there and stuff, and everyone's got that really loud aunt, you know, and who's, like, all excited and stuff. And anyway, I just remember that time she broke the news to everyone, and it was this huge deal because this is going to be the first grandchild, right? So it was a big ordeal, and everyone was really excited for her. Then out of nowhere, she was born premature. She weighed less than 2 pounds. Her whole body could fit in one hand. I was in junior high, and I didn't really understand kind of the implications that was, that, you know, premature birth, how dangerous that could be. She was little. She lived a little bit longer than a month, and died. And there were countless people in the funeral home. I remember people filing through that little room, one after the other, to look inside of this casket that could have hardly fit a Bible in it. So people are filing through and kind of get through the room, and there's so many people we had to kind of end up in the lobby afterwards. And so you walk through, and then you leave the room, go down this long hallway to the lobby, and we're all kind of waiting there. And then Chandra and Drew go in there and, you know, shut the doors. And I remember to this day the sounds that you could hear all the way down that hallway, my oldest sister screaming and yelling at God. How could he do this? This is an injustice. It's not fair. There's no way that this, is a good thing. Saying, you know, I hate him. I hate you, yelling and screaming. I know I wasn't the only one who heard it. Anyway, the funeral was kind of the same way, crying the whole way through it. Same kind of things. She knew in her heart that God did exist, but why did he not intervene? She knew that God was all-powerful and omniscient and almighty, but where was he, and why did he not care about her and her little girl? She became pregnant again and had a miscarriage, and came pregnant again, had another miscarriage, and it's like as if the death of your first child isn't enough. Why would she have to go through that same thing again? Why would she have to go through that same pain? And this was a question that all of us were asking, why? And once again, her assumption of God was affirmed that he exists, but he must not care. Fast forward a couple years to her fourth pregnancy, and everything was going great. And then the doctor said that her body wasn't responding well to the pregnancy and that she would have to go on this certain medication and be on bed rest for the last 6 months of her pregnancy. I didn't understand that that was a bad thing because I was like, not even having to get out of bed for 6 months, that's a miracle. But that would have been awesome for me. But anyway, Andrew Cannon Perkins was born. Very healthy, beautiful blue eyes, perfect smile, full term, healthy baby. And that's him. And there's another one also. That's one of my favorite ones. And then it took him a while. He wasn't learning how to sit up by himself, wasn't walking when he was supposed to, developing physically very slow. So they went in and diagnosed him with an infinitesimally rare disease called glycogen storage disease type 4. It's a disease of the liver. And they said he's not going to live past 2 years old unless he gets a liver transplant. And I don't know how much you know about a liver transplant, but you can't live without a liver, meaning whoever the donor family was, some little boy or some little girl was going to have to die so that Cannon could live. And how could Chandra, with the death of three children already, wish that on someone else? Knowing the pain and the heartbreak and the agony, how could you dare pray or wish for the death of another child so that yours could live? It was one of the first outward prayers that Christ in Action did in, I guess it was 2005 or something. And they prayed for, this was before I even came here, Christ in Action prayed for Cannon. People all over were praying for Cannon. And LCU raised money and made donations also. They found out that the total cost above what their insurance was going to pay for him was estimated to be $250,000. And again, the question is, where is God in all this? The wrestling continued not only for her, but for our whole family. Why now? Hasn't she gone through enough? Hasn't he gone through enough? Why is your glory still not present in this situation? If I were to ask you to describe God in, you know, one or two words, a lot of us would say something like almighty, majestic, powerful, omniscient, those kinds of words, awesome. All those things are great ways to describe God, but I think there's a flaw when we try to use only those kinds of words, and I'll get back to that later. But right now, go to Genesis 32. I think it'll be up here also. starting in verse 9. And Jacob said, O God of my father Abraham, and God of my father Isaac, O Lord, who said to me, Return to your country and to your kindred, that I may do you good. I am not worthy of the least of all the deeds of steadfast love and all the faithfulness that you have shown to your servant. For with only my staff I crossed this Jordan, and now I have become two camps. Please deliver me from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, that he may come and attack me, the mothers with their children. But you said, I will surely do you good and make your offspring as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitude. So he stayed there that night, and from what he had with him, he took a present for his brother Esau, 200 female goats and 20 male goats, 200 ewes and 20 rams, 30 milking camels and their calves, 40 cows and 10 bulls, 20 female donkeys and 10 male donkeys. These he handed over to his servants. Every drove by itself and said to his servant, pass on ahead of me and put a space between drove and drove. He instructed the first, when Esau my brother meets you and asks you, to whom do you belong, where are you going, and whose are these ahead of you? Then you shall say, they belong to your servant Jacob. They are a present sent to my lord Esau, and moreover, he is behind us. He likewise instructed the second and the third and all who followed the droves. You shall say the same thing to Esau when you find him, and you shall say, moreover, your servant Jacob is behind us. For he thought, I may appease him with the present that goes ahead of me, and afterward I shall see his face. Perhaps he will accept me. So the present passed on ahead of him, and he himself stayed that night in the camp. The same night he arose and took his two wives, his two female servants, and his 11 children, and crossed the ford of the Jabbok. He took them and sent them across the stream and everything else that he had. And Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until the breaking of the day. In all of Scripture, is there a more random statement? And a man wrestled with him until the breaking of the day. Some people believe that this character was like a river troll or something like that. I did some of those books that David was talking about. These scholars believe, you know, this is kind of a folkloric telling. And so since it was at a river, like the three billy goats who try to get over the river, and there's the troll who tries to eat all the... They think this is like, you know, one of these troll things or whatever. What? There's a troll. So I kind of laugh every time I get to this now, because like I'm going to think of like this little troll kind of like, grr. But no, it wasn't a troll. It was certainly God that he was wrestling with. But why? Jacob has gone about his whole life wrestling with God, with his family. So why now? It kind of makes me think of Super Smash Brothers. You know, you defeat Kirby and then Mario, and now you got to face the big hand at the end or whatever. but anyway. But this kind of wrestling is not a bad one. Wrestling with God is never a bad thing. And I'll tell you why later. If you've gone your entire life struggle after struggle, not knowing if you could make the next step, and finally you confront God face to face, how awesome would that be? To finally know that God truly is present in a weird kind of way. Last week, David talked about glory. Talks about this weight that God has and that he uses. But I want to expand on that a little bit. Some of you may have heard the term Shekinah, like Shekinah glory. It's not used in the Bible a whole lot. But it's a very strong Hebrew notion, the Shekinah glory of God, kind of used to describe this presence that God has among His people. And so the pillar of fire in the Exodus would have been a perfect example of the Shekinah glory of God. The light that surrounded the temple and the Ark of the Covenant was God's Shekinah glory, His presence among those things. When you see a painting of a Catholic saint and they have that golden kind of circle behind them, that's kind of their depiction of this Shekinah glory. God's present, abiding glory among His people. I have a puppy named Snickers. And he'll act differently when he knows that I'm present. Like, I'll hear him in the other room chewing on something, and so I'll go over and just, like, stand over him, and all of a sudden he'll, like, freeze and realize what he's doing, and, like, look, I'll be like, oops. And it's really fun. We act differently when we know that God is present with us. Cannon did receive his liver transplant, and the whole story is really miraculous. He still got that scar. It's a big kind of, I don't know what you call it, the three incisions going that way. They had to open up, I mean, that whole area to put his liver in. Usually you never get to meet the family who donates their child's liver. But the donor actually heard of Cannon, or the donor family actually heard of Cannon, and said, we want our boy's liver, Jordan was his name, to go to him. And it was really cool how it worked out. Blood type was all the same and everything. He had a website that people read Chandra's journal entries that she wrote, and she's an amazing writer. She's actually getting a book written that I'm looking forward to reading. But, I mean, this website had tons of hits a day from people from Russia and China and Australia. Every state in the United States was represented. Hundreds of thousands of people knew about him. And they would say things to Cannon saying, you have taught me how to pray. You have strengthened my faith. And amazing things like that. There's one more picture. As soon as he got it, he couldn't walk until he got his transplant. And as soon as he got it, before he even ever left Houston, he just got up on his feet and started walking. And it was really cool. But let's go back to Genesis 32, starting in verse 25. When the man saw that he did not prevail against Jacob, he touched his hip socket, and Jacob's hip was put out of joint as he wrestled with him. Then he said, let me go, for the day has broken. But Jacob said, I will not let you go unless you bless me. How beautiful is this picture that Jacob's is wrestling with this ethereal being. And of course, he's not going to beat God, but he refuses to let go of God. How cool would it be, you know, even if God wanted to get rid of you, he couldn't. You know, you're holding on that tightly to him. I think that's a really cool picture. How many times I think that I've been in a struggle with God and just decided to let go. And how those situations might have been differently if I'd held on to him and continue to struggle with him. And that's one of the reasons that I love my sister so much, is because she never let go of the hope that she had. And all this testing, she says now in retrospect, was strengthening her. And this wrestling with God made her feel weak at times, but says now that through Amberlee and Cannon, that they glorified God. So there I got that word in. Through all this wrestling, she, like Jacob, came to realize the close presence of God and His glory despite the situation. Go back to Genesis 32, starting in verse 27 now. And he said to him, "What is your name?" And he said, "Jacob." Then he said, "Your name shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with God and with men and have prevailed." I read some arguments that people say this wasn't God or any kind of manifestation of God because he had to ask him his name, and so it's not any kind of omniscient being. But God has to ask Adam, or doesn't have to ask him, but God chooses to ask Adam in the garden, "Where are you?" So, you know, God still answers questions. He can know the answer and still ask it. Anyway, so God asks him what his name is, and Jacob has to say, "My name is Jacob. My name is the devious one, the cheat," is what Jacob means. And God tells him, "Because you refuse to let go of me, your name will no longer be the devious one. Your name is no longer the cheat, but your name is Israel, the one who strives with God." I researched a little bit kind of Hebrew names and stuff. And the subject is more God. So more literally it would read, "God strives." So when we wrestle with God, he changes our name to God strives. It's no longer this, "I'm striving for myself." God is the one who's striving. God becomes your strength and your weakness. My family found out last week that Chandra was diagnosed with cervical cancer. And she's scheduled for surgery in a couple weeks. But the danger is that the area is in a gland, and so they're afraid that it could very easily spread to her lymphatic system or to her bloodstream, which would make the situation exponentially worse. Anyway, after that, she might, you know, need to go through some chemo and everything, just depending on how the hysterectomy goes. So who knows? But Chandra said she's constantly been getting calls from people day after day saying, you know, "This is just not fair. You know, why you, after all you've been through? It's not fair that you should have to go through this, who has strengthened so many people's faith. And, you know, your family has, you know, caused so many people to be lifted up. And you've glorified God in every decision you've made. Why you? This isn't fair." And she says that she's come to be able to tell others that it's okay because God will be glorified no matter what happens. And she told me, what better way is there to show her love for God regardless of the outcome? And of course, this response has floored everyone, you know, who she tells that to. You know, they just end up kind of speechless. You mean you're not, mad at God? You're okay not feeling confident in what the future holds? And she actually told me, worst case scenario, I die and I get to see my little girl again, which is hard to think about for me. But she really has adopted Paul's mentality: to live is Christ and to die is gain. Back to verse 29 in Genesis. Then Jacob asked him, "Please tell me your name." But he said, "Why is it that you ask my name?" And there he blessed him. So Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, saying, "For I have seen God face to face, and yet my life has been delivered." The sun rose upon him as he passed. Peniel limping because of his hip. Therefore, to this day, the people of Israel do not eat the sinew of the thigh, that is on the hip socket, because he touched the socket of Jacob's hip on the sinew of the thigh. So when you wrestle with God, you leave with a few things. You leave with a name change. You leave as a different person. Your attitude changes and your lifestyle changes. Everything in your life is different because you wrestled with God. Another thing you leave with is a limp. Tim showed me his scar on his thigh from when he broke his femur in high school. And it's huge. It like goes all the way from there to there. And I can't imagine the pain that would have been involved in that. Luckily, he healed. Jacob has to go the rest of his life with a limp. How can that possibly be a good thing? He probably went on to his dying day with a bum leg. But every step that he took for the rest of his life reminded him, God is God and I am not. God is the one with the power, and it is He who is my strength, and it is Him who strives for me. I wish that I had some kind of physical, I don't know, something that would remind me of that, that God is God and I am not. After you wrestle with God and experience His abiding presence and glory, how can that not change your view of Him and yourself? And that's the third thing you leave with when you wrestle with God, is a paradigm change. I asked you earlier a word that you think of when you think of God. This Western industrial world, when we think of those kind of, you know, things, attributes of God, we think, you know, awesome, omniscient, almighty, all-powerful, you know, holy, majestic, and those kinds of things. But if you were to ask an Eastern person, particularly a Jew, and especially an ancient Hebrew, they would describe God more like this. The God who has been my shepherd all my life to this day, my hiding place and my protector. The Lord is my peace. You are a shield around me. We're more quick to say what God is and describe Him rather than recognize what it is that He does in our lives and the role that He plays. How much more sincerely would we glorify God if we looked at Him not merely as this all-powerful being, but as our all-powerful shield and protector, as our shepherd? Sometimes we forget that not only is God the one who created and established and ordered the universe, but He's also the one who in Genesis 2 walked with Adam in the garden. The reason my sister is able to respond to people the way she does now is because God is no longer this distant, almighty, all-powerful person up there who's just watching things, you know, happen and unfold. But now she is, you know, her shepherd, her protector. The role that He plays in her life is completely different now. God is the one who gives us the opportunity to live in His presence. And how much more sincerely would we worship and glorify God, knowing His Shekinah glory in our lives right now. So we're going to sing one song. And I just want you to keep this in mind for the rest of tonight and on. When you glorify God, who is it you're glorifying? What kind of role does He play in your life?